we have implemented some steps to increase accountability within the project team and to make sure that there is robust documentation of land ownership status.
Alaska Native organizations accuse a state agency of trespassing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state files an appeal in the Kuskokwim subsistence fisherman trial.
The cross appeal is just to make sure that we preserve our ability to make whatever arguments we might later decide to make.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A group of seven Alaska Native corporations and associations are accusing the Alaska Energy Authority of trespassing as the agency does preliminary study work on the Susitna-Wautana Dam project. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
The concerns are laid out in a letter addressed to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who is in charge of licensing projects like the proposed 735-foot-high dam. The Alaska Energy Authority, or AEA, is currently conducting 58 studies to gauge the environmental impact and viability of the Susitna-Wautana Dam. According to the letter signed by representatives of the Cook Inlet Region Native Landowner Working Group, 39 of the 58 projects will require the use of Native-owned land. The working group expressed concerns over trespassing by AEA contractors on Native land in both 2012 and 2013. According to the letter, two helipads were constructed without permits on land belonging to Kinnikotnu Incorporated earlier this year, while efforts were still being made to reconcile trespassing issues from 2012. Robert Baller, board coordinator for the Chickaloon Moose Creek Native Association, says there have been trespass issues on lands belonging to the corporation, but that it seems like resolution is on the way. Ethan Schutt, a senior vice president at CIRI, says that the joint letter expresses the concerns of the whole group and that he was not willing to speak on behalf of all seven Alaska Native corporations. He says that the working group is currently working with AEA to arrange a face-to-face meeting. Emily Ford, a spokesperson for AEA, acknowledges that the helipads were cleared on Kinnikotnu Village Corporation land and says that AEA is taking the matter seriously.
AEA has made direct changes to avoid these issues moving forward. There has been some staffing changes, some personnel changes made, and we have implemented some steps to increase accountability within the project team and to make sure that there is robust documentation of land ownership status and all necessary permits.
Ford says AEA believes it has a good safety structure and that the problem is poor communication of the existing policies to groups who are not part of the field teams. The members of the Native Corporation's working group have not issued permits for AEA studies to be conducted on their land this year. Ford explains how AEA is proceeding with this year's research.
We have all of the necessary permits to execute this year's field season outside of CIRI and Cook Inlet Village Corporation lands. And we look forward to engaging with the landowners to develop a successful framework for future permitting. At this time, the project does remain on schedule.
At this time, both sides say the process is ongoing. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has not made a public response to the working group's letter. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The state of Alaska has submitted a cross appeal in the Kuskokwim fishermen trials. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
About two dozen fishermen were convicted in Bethel Court in May for taking king salmon last summer when restrictions were in place. 15 fishermen are appealing that decision. The fishermen are arguing that they have the religious freedom to fish, even during closures, because of their traditional Yupik beliefs. The state is arguing that they don't. The state already prevailed in the Bethel Court, and they want the Court of Appeals to confirm the convictions. Assistant Attorney General Laura Fox says it wasn't totally necessary for them to submit a cross appeal, but they wanted to make sure they covered all bases.
The cross appeal is just to make sure that we preserve our ability to make whatever arguments we might later decide to make.
She says it's like a placeholder for possible arguments, but they won't decide on their exact stance until the briefs are filed later on. The briefing schedule has not been set by the court. The fisherman's attorney, James Davis Jr., says the state's cross appeal means more than that.
we're disappointed that the state has filed a cross appeal to, you know, make this litigation even more complicated rather than trying to work with subsistence users to protect subsistence rights.
The state's cross appeal mentions the case Frank versus the state and says that the lower court erred in concluding that the fishermen's conduct was religiously based. Judge Bruce Ward found that subsistence fishing was religious in nature, but it wasn't enough to discount state restrictions. Davis says Frank versus the state is a landmark case that protects everyone's religious freedoms, and for the state to include it in its cross appeal for possible questioning is disturbing.
Frank is one of those signature cases from our court unique to Alaska, which is so expansive of everybody's religious freedom.
During the Bethel trials, the Yupik fishermen spoke of their belief in the creator, Thumwa, who is not pleased if they don't take what's offered, in this case, king salmon. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Federal investigators are saying the plane crash in Soldotna could have been caused by a stalled engine. Agents with the National Transportation Safety Board have been on the Kenai Peninsula since Monday examining the wreckage. 10 people, including one local pilot and two families visiting from Greenville, South Carolina, were on board when it crashed late Sunday morning. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve has this update.
Investigators are considering every possible scenario that could have caused the de Havilland DHC-3 Otter to crash just after takeoff. NTSB member Earl Wainer says they're examining the position of the flight control panel because that could lend support to the theory that the aircraft's engine stalled that morning.
Yes, we're looking at it, certainly with a great deal of interest, but we have not determined that that was the case.
He says agents also are paying attention to the weight and balance of the plane. Wainer says Radisky Air owner and pilot Walter Radisky was taking the 9 passengers along with baggage and supplies for a bear viewing trip on the Alaska Peninsula.
The medical examiner has been helpful in determining weights. The operator has been helpful in determining what got loaded on the airplane. The lodge has been helpful in determining what they got invoices for in terms of the supplies and freight. We're weighing the baggage. We're weighing everything that comes off the airplane. So we will be able to develop, we think, a fairly good estimate of what the weight is. And then the balance, where people were sitting, we have a pretty good idea of that as well.
Investigators initially examined the crash site itself before moving the plane to a hangar. Wainer says they discovered a ground scar where the engine impacted the ground, which could give them more clues.
The first thing you can determine is the direction that it was moving at the time of the impact. It also gives you some kind of qualitative idea about how fast it was moving in the horizontal direction. The depth gives you some qualitative idea of what the vertical velocities were, but these are not something that you can back up and say, well, it was so many knots in forward direction and so many knots in vertical.
Wainer says the next step is to establish a 72-hour timeline of events leading up to the crash. That's typical for all the agency's investigations. The fact that the Otter was not required to have a voice recorder or in-flight data recorder on board will prove to be a challenge. Investigators will not be able to pick up clues from those, but Wainer said they did find 5 cell phones in the wreckage. He says the agency is still looking for eyewitnesses as well. Investigators will be in Soldotna the next few days determining which pieces will be sent back to the NTSB lab in Washington, D.C. A preliminary report is expected in about 30 days. In Homer, with assistance from APRN's Ellen Lockyer, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a former state biologist says give salmon a break.
My personal choice is not to fish for wild king salmon stocks in the Northern District.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The Stewart Creek 2 fire is now 22% contained, but 770 firefighters and personnel aren't ready to let down their guard. Spokesman Richard Hadley says an evacuation watch for the communities of Two Rivers and Pleasant Valley is still in place.
Not quite out of the woods, but we're getting closer, and we're just erring on the side of caution before we remove any advisory.
Hadley says officials aren't yet ready to change their fire management strategy to battle the more than 84,000-acre blaze.
As we start wrapping up some of the work, then we'll start releasing firefighters. But we're kind of in a holding pattern here while we see what the weather does the next several days.
Hadley says they're building a fire line before warmer, drier conditions move in. According to the National Weather Service, temperatures in the central interior could climb into the lower 80s by Saturday. Chinook salmon runs are poor all over the state, but especially so in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, where sports fishing restrictions have been in place most of the season. Now, a former state fisheries biologist says fishermen could help boost Chinook escapement by voluntarily not fishing at all. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
It's looking like another poor Chinook year in the Northern District. Last year's Chinook runs barely made state escapement goals, and this year may turn out to be even worse. And that means lower bag limits and restrictions on gear and opportunity, according to Sam Ivey, state sports fish manager for the Matanuska-Susitna area.
So we started the season on the Little Sioux only allowing harvest on Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays, and catch and release during the week. And on a good portion of the Yentna, allowing harvest 4 days a week and catch and release the rest of the week. And then also on the Deschka River, we went 7 days a week. Harvest is allowed. It was just that we started the season single hook artificial only, and so started that fishery off without bait.
The Deschka River has met its escapement goal at the low end of the range, and data is not in on all the other creeks, Ivy says. But he says the department has managed to provide opportunity despite the poor returns. But Howard Delo, who is on the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's Fish and Wildlife Commission, says most restrictions, especially catch and release fishing, aren't really helping the Chinook runs.
You can kill a fish through catch and release if you fight it to exhaustion or you drag it up into the sand on the bank and step on it while you're pulling the hook out and kick it back into the water, which I have actually seen some people do and then call themselves catch and release fishermen. That fish is dead. It will not survive to get into the brood year cycle.
Delo, who is a retired state fisheries biologist, says sports fishermen can help boost poor runs by simply standing down.
My personal choice is not to fish for wild king salmon stocks in the Northern District until the wild stock situation improves significantly.
Delo says not fishing at all could be the best way to boost returns in the long run, even though it may not make a noticeable difference now.
If 10 people decided they're not going to go out and try and catch a king salmon, is that going to be a significance? It's hard to say, but that could be 10 more fish that then do ultimately get into the brood stock.
Delo's no fishing idea sounds altruistic, but in reality, it's going to take a toll on fishing guides and sports supply incomes. The sports fishing industry at one time brought millions of dollars into the Matanuska-Susitna Borough annually. But last year, early Chinook fishing closures took a toll on area revenues. Don Dyer is with the borough's Economic Development Department.
5 years ago, the sport fishing industry to the Matsu Borough was worth about $120 million. Per year. Because of the poor salmon returns over the last 5 years, as of last year, it's collapsed to about a $20 million a year industry.
Dyer says although the borough doesn't tax sports fishing guides' incomes, the state stands to lose some money due to the poor fishing.
The government that has suffered the most loss of income has been the state of Alaska because a lot of these guides lease land from the state on the river frontages, and they haven't been able to make their payments, and there have been, it's wiped out, this loss of fish has wiped out a whole way of life for a lot of people and has ruined a lot of businesses.
Since there are poor Chinook runs everywhere from the Kenai to the Copper this year, Delo says fishermen can help by targeting other species, hatchery reds on the Kenai Peninsula or locally stocked Chinook at the Eklutna Tail Race. Sports fishers bent on catching a king better get busy because the Northern District Sport King season ends at 11 p.m. this Saturday. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Kenai Peninsula lost one of its most influential figures Wednesday. Clayton Brockle, the founding director of Kenai Peninsula College, died. He was 85. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Clayton Brockle was chosen as the first director of KPC in 1963. He had been an English teacher in the Kenai City School District, famously working out of a 1963 Chevy sedan, which he called Old Blue. He traveled the peninsula, slowly building the support and the infrastructure to provide post-secondary education on the Kenai.
Believe me, his job when he got here to create the college is much more difficult than anybody that followed him.
That's Gary Turner, the college's current director.
It's a very difficult day for us. It's the end of an era. You know, Clayton was the founder of KPC and started things in 1963, 1964. And there's only ever one founder. There's only ever one first. And that was Clayton. And he was quite a man. He was quite a leader. And we will really miss him.
He says Brockle's experience and his continued involvement with the college have been invaluable over the past five decades.
You have to understand these jobs are not the easiest. There's a lot of politics in these jobs. And Clayton was one guy because he'd been there before. And he was a guy I could believe in and trust, and he would provide me the advice and the suggestions and the recommendations that made my job easier. I don't know how I would have managed without that.
Next year is a big year for institutions on the Kenai. The college, the borough, and the borough school district all turn 50.
One coin for each organization. And on the front of each will be the likeness of Clayton Brockle, Harold Pomeroy, who was the first borough mayor, and Sterling Sears, who was the first school district superintendent. And on the obverse side of those coins will be the logo for each of those organizations. So yesterday, we took the wax sculptures of these men to show to Clayton so he could see that project. He had known about it. We had talked to him about it. So it was pretty fitting the day before he passed that he got to see his likeness, and it's going to be on a coin. So that was pretty special.
Clayton Brockle is survived by his wife, Jean. He was preceded in death by his son, John, in 2008. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Every summer, thousands of visitors travel to Katmai National Park and Preserve. Most of them are there to see the park's number one attraction, the brown bears that fish for salmon at Brooks Falls. Now, thanks to a new project, people all over the world can watch the famous bears, too. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
Charles Annenberg Weingarten is the founder and director of Explore.org. Weingarten says he started the nonprofit organization to shine a light or a camera on what he calls the soul of humanity. Part of that mission is to explore the natural world in its most unscripted and, well, natural form. Weingarten says there's no better way to do that than with live webcams showcasing some of nature's greatest creatures, places, and scenes. Weingarten calls the live cam series Pearls of the Planet.
And Pearls of the Planet is a series of live cams that really allows, I hope, people to connect with nature up close and personal in a way that I consider as pure as possible. So there's no gimmicks, no sales, no advertising, and it's just a conduit that connects us from our world to the natural world.
The newest in the series of live nature cams just debuted last week at Brooks Falls inside Katmai National Park. Weingarten says the scene at Brooks Falls, where bears mingle with park visitors competing for salmon making their way up the Brooks River, has already become his favorite of the dozens of live cams to be found at explore.org.
Brooks Falls and the brown bears of Brooks Falls with the salmon is one of the most iconic visuals in the history of nature, if you were to think about it. Like if we were an athlete saying, what are the great moments? Well, this is one of the great moments in the natural world. When you look at that water running, you know, the salmon going upstream, the bears in the setting, the eagles flying overhead, the seagulls flying, you're really capturing purity at its greatest.
There are a total of 6 cameras installed at various points around Brooks Camp, although only 4 of them are online now. As you watch the bears fish, play, and even mate, the cameras will zoom out, pan, and zoom in, depending on where the bears are and what they're doing. Weingarten has staff members and volunteers controlling the cameras remotely from Explore.org's offices in Los Angeles. As I interviewed Weingarten for this story, I couldn't help but find myself distracted by the antics of the bears.
Look, there's a bear ripping a salmon apart right now.
Yeah, I mean, we've been... Oh, really, right now?
Yeah, right now. He just pulled it on shore.
Yeah, hold on, because I switched over the phone.
With the permission of park rangers, the Explore.org team installed the cameras beginning last year. To power them, the team also installed a series of solar panels and batteries on top of a mountain near the falls. Technical problems have prevented the group from finishing a couple of project goals, including an audio feed and an underwater camera. But Weingarten says the launch of the cameras over the 4th of July weekend went well, and the number of visitors has been steadily rising ever since. He refers to the experience of watching the bears in real time as Sesame Street for adults.
You know, we try to make learning fun again in a very user-friendly, simplistic way. To me, in a world that's so filled with stress and chaos, if I can get you to escape, relax, be in the moment, and develop an emotional connection with nature, we've succeeded.
Weingarten says that if you think operating the cameras at Brooks Falls sounds like an interesting job, and you don't mind relocating to California, he is taking applications. In the meantime, you can check out the brown bears of Katmai National Park by visiting explore.org. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
With its temperate rainforest climate, Southeast Alaska is a prime location for amphibians like frogs and salamanders. But scientists in the state have barely explored the creatures. One University of Alaska graduate student, with the help of a Petersburg resident, is trying to change that. KFSK's Robbie Feinberg has the story.
This whole area in here is loaded with them.
Seth Perry is walking into a wooded remote area, only a few miles from downtown Petersburg. Huge trees surround him. The only sign of human life here is a broken-down trailer with vines crawling all over it. Perry walks towards it, crouches, and turns over a small rectangular piece of wood that's fallen off the structure.
There's one.
There, lying right below, are 6 newts, their blackish-purple skin curled up into tiny balls the size of quarters. Perry grabs one and exposes its peach-orange belly.
It's just a rough-skinned newt. See, this one's got very rough skin. He's a young adult male. This would be a juvenile, actually.
If you asked most Petersburg residents, they'd probably say they've never seen a single newt on the island. But Perry knows they're here. He spent his childhood summers near Petersburg's ball fields, searching for newts and wood frogs along ponds and brooks.
I never found these much when I was a kid. I caught frogs, but these are some of my favorites now.
As the years have passed, though, Perry has started to see less and less of the amphibians around. They're still abundant, he says, but nowhere near the level they were decades ago. And that worries him. So when he saw a posting online a few years ago about a graduate student who wanted to explore the amphibians in the area, he saw an opportunity. He messaged the student online, and soon they were planning a trip to explore the unknown remote islands of Southeast Alaska, an expedition across the Stikine River to chronicle every frog, newt, salamander, and toad they could find.
The opportunity to get on the river, to have a volunteer that has a boat that's able to take me to those places, and everything being new information to science is exciting.
That's Josh Rehm, the graduate student and Perry's new research partner. Rehm moved a few years ago to study at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. He's always loved learning about the outdoors, especially amphibians. But when he came to Alaska, he hit a brick wall. There was barely any information on Alaskan amphibians anywhere. The best he could find was a 1991 study by the U.S. Forest Service, and that was it. Rehm was shocked. He says there needs to be more research done, because amphibians are important.
They play amphibians at least, an important role in the food chains in many areas. They can be very abundant in different areas. They provide a great food source for birds and small mammals and fish. They also eat a huge quantity of mosquitoes.
But unfortunately, Reem says, science funding doesn't consider that. Organizations have to weigh what studies are most important. And in Alaska, most of the time that ends up being studies on fish, and salmon especially. Reem was able to snag one of those grants to fund his research last year. But this year, he wasn't so lucky. So instead of looking for money from governmental organizations, Reem turned to an unlikely source, the public.
I've been funding part of the research just through my own personal funds. But my advisor suggested several months ago that I look into some of these alternative sources, and one of the sources was this GoFundMe project.
Crowdfunding is a relatively new idea for scientists. Websites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo have enabled a lot of musicians and inventors to become successful. But for scientists, it's no sure thing. But luckily for Reem, it worked. He raised the money, and Reem and Perry came out this summer to cruise island to island along the Stikine. They just returned from their second expedition last month. They traveled through the Wrangell and Petersburg areas, making stops on the Stikine River and other remote places. Reem said the experience was informative, but what made it truly unique is that no one's really done it before.
You know, I never know when I'm going to find something that no one else has in the area. And, you know, I think in the lower 48, many of the same questions were answered, you know, perhaps 100 or 200 years ago.
This year's trip was pretty successful. He and Perry found twin-toed salamanders near the Twin Lakes on the Stikine, which some had thought had disappeared in the past. And at Mallard Slough near Petersburg, they found long-toed salamanders, notable for their slender yellow stripes down their backs. Reem says he can't make any conclusions about what's happening to the animals quite yet. But his goal is to document exactly what species are in the area and to look for changes to those species into the future. In Petersburg, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ariel Van Cleve and Aaron Selbig in Homer, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Robbie Feinberg in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.